And so Canada is obliged to, you know, abide by the International Court of Justice's rulings on almost a little more than a year ago on genocide, and the advisory opinion, which is, of course, it's not bound legally to abide by the recommendations of the ICJ, but the General Assembly has ruled. This is Canada's obligation. It is your right to defend the rights of the Palestinian people and to speak out publicly, but it's the obligation of the Canadian government to act to stop not simply or just genocide, although it's pretty bad, but apartheid and the gravest, most grievous breaches of international humanitarian and human rights law, and the Trudeau government's not doing it.
Yeah, as I pointed out to people who rallied on the Thursday morning when I showed up at the detention center, instead of pursuing me for social media posts, the Montreal police should be investigating the Canadians who have fought in the Israeli military under Canada's War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity Act. There was just a website that posted about listing at least 85 Canadians that have been fighting in the Israeli military in recent years. So, yeah, I mean, in a modestly just society, we would be, the policing and judicial structures would be devoting resources to pursuing Canadians who fought. Other things like the Foreign Enlistment Act, about all these groups that have induced Canadians to assist the Israeli military, right? That's on the Canadian, that's the Canadian law. We did, as you know, 4 years ago, we did a, I guess 5 years ago now, maybe, we did a whole thing where we compiled evidence about groups and individuals violating the Foreign Enlistment Act by inducing Canadians to join or assist the Israeli military. And we presented that to the RCMP, or initially presented to the Attorney General, the Justice Minister. And he said, oh, it's nothing to do with me. So this is a policing matter. We presented to the RCMP. They don't move with it. And we, you know, had all these prominent people that signed it, and very strong legal document on that. If you look at the Canada Revenue Agency rules that say it's contrary to rules for registered charities, you know, subsidized by the Canadian state, to assist a foreign military, not just the Israeli military, but any foreign military. And we know that a group like the Hesek Foundation has raised about $200 million over the past 20 years to assist non-Israelis to join the Israeli military. They provide all kinds of bursaries and different kind of funding, mostly around education, but other more broadly as well, to non, you know, Montrealers, Torontonians, Parisians, New Yorkers, who go and join the Israeli military. That clearly violates the CRA rules. So there's all these ways in which Canadian law is being violated in assisting the Israeli military, which has been, you know, over the past 16 months, committing horror after horror in Gaza, but also has just been, you know, overseeing this brutal occupation of the West Bank, of course, has been bombing Syria, has been bombing Lebanon, has, you know, been at war basically all the time for the past 75 years of the country's existence. And so the Canadian government has legal obligations to uphold its laws, and the police should be investigating these matters, but they don't, because it's the political culture is deeply anti-Palestinian, deeply Zionist, and it's instead of...
And deeply anti the rule of law, ironically enough. No one has spoken out more passionately in favor of the international rules-based order than young Justin Trudeau, and yet his government is steadfastly opposed to upholding not simply international humanitarian human rights law, but Canadian domestic laws that reflect those international statutes.
And instead it's the hundreds and hundreds of activists across the country who are campaigning for Canada to follow its obligations under the Arms Trade Treaty, which is into domestic Canadian law, which says you can't sell weapons to countries involved in human rights violations. Obviously, Israel's involved in human rights violations, and yet they have, you know, they have paused, they say, we don't know for sure, but they say they've paused some permits for arms sales. So, yeah, it's the people who are, to a large extent, I say this many times, if we could just force the Canadian government to uphold its own laws with regards to Israel, we would have a huge, that would be a huge contribution to Palestinian liberation. And instead, it's the activists who are, to a large extent, just pressing the government structures to uphold its own laws that are finding themselves jailed or targeted by the security institutions.
Eve Engler, last question. You have a legal defense fund. I'm sure you've incurred costs. How can people help out in your legal struggle?
Yeah, I haven't set up a formal legal defense fund at this point. John Philpott is my lawyer has been very gracious in doing this, but there is a donate page on my website. I think the thing at this point that I'm mostly looking for, we're going to be coming out public with some more stuff. Like I said, they just targeted the senator for defending me and others, so we're going to go public with some of this stuff hopefully soon. And I'm certainly going to be doing some other campaigning around the charges. I think this is, I don't see this as really a legal thing. I see this is all political. So I want to I guess you call it escalate everything politically.
You enjoy doing that.
I enjoy doing that. And I think that when you're right, not just in the narrow of like right in that, no, I didn't harass Dalia Kurtz, and no, I didn't harass the Montreal police, but right in the more important way that what is or Canada's supporting in terms of Israel's crimes, I think it's so we're so abundantly right that we should be as open and direct. And if there may be consequences, I did spend 5 days in jail because I escalated things and because I talked about it and responded, didn't just sort of accept the police conditions and the police, could have done it all quietly and just had the case, hope the Crown dropped the charges against me and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's important to go public. Politically, it's important. I've gotten all these messages from people who've been had similar type things happen to them, but don't have as high a profile or haven't been sort of hyped up. And people's reaction when the charges and the threats come against them is to get very worried and to go in a total opposite direction. And I think we need to be much more kind of bold in our pushback to this lawfare and abuse of state power on behalf or in service of Israel's crimes against Palestinians.
Eve Engler is a Montreal-based writer and human rights activist. Among his 13 published works, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, together with Owen Schalk, Stand on Guard for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military, House of Mirrors, Justin Trudeau's Foreign Policy, Left-Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada, and A Propaganda System, How Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. We'll link to Eve Engler's website at greenplanetmonitor.net. We'll also post a complete video of our conversation. Imagine a squadron of U.S. F-35 jets roaring over a football stadium in Calgary or Winnipeg or Toronto, packed with Maple Leaf-waving fans at Canada's Fall Classic, the annual championship game of the Canadian Football League, the Grey Cup, or over the funeral of a venerated Canadian politician who'd had the temerity to champion Canadian cultural and economic sovereignty in the face of U.S. imperialism. In both not-so-fanciful instances, Donald Trump's message would be clear. Don't boo our national anthem. Give us your oil, gas, and minerals. Become our 51st state. Or else, a couple of weekends ago, a handful of Israeli F-35 fighter bombers delivered a message of just this sort, flying low over a stadium in Beirut, Lebanon, packed with mourners at the funeral of Hassan Nasrallah, charismatic Shia leader and secretary general of the Party of God, Hezbollah, brutally murdered 5 months earlier in a rain of U.S. bunker buster bombs. For an eyewitness account of the February 23rd funeral of Hassan Nasrallah and Israel's low-altitude flyovers, it was more than one, the GPM turned to Dimitri Lascaris. Lascaris is a Canadian lawyer, human rights advocate, and journalist. So you attended Hassan Nasrallah's funeral yesterday in Beirut. Tell me about that.
Well, I was there as a journalist, and there were hundreds of media, hundreds of persons, journalists, camera crews that came from all around the world. And so I had to get media accreditation, which I did through people in the, you know, Lebanese journalists here who've known me for a while. And I was part of a team of about five journalists, all of whom I knew personally, who entered the stadium with hundreds of others. We were driven by a bus from a hotel. It was complete chaos at the hotel, trying to get our press passes. We were brought by bus, as were all the journalists, and we went into an underground tunnel that had been reserved exclusively for us. And when we came up out of the tunnel, we came into the stadium that was jam-packed with people. It has a capacity of about 60,000. I didn't see an empty seat in the place. Hezbollah flags were being waved everywhere. This was more than an hour before the funeral actually began. And outside the stadium, there were throngs of people. We had to, you know, be shepherded through these massive throngs of people in order to get into the tunnel. I can tell you, you know, it went on for 12 hours, the whole thing, from the time we came into the stadium to the time we left the shrine of Hassan Nasrallah. You know, in the middle, we can talk about this if you'd like, but after the ceremony at the stadium, there was a march, a 2-kilometer march, with the coffin of Nasrallah at the head of the march, involving what may well have been in excess of 100,000 marchers, to the shrine, which was about 2 kilometers away.
Any Israeli overflights? Any sound breaking the sound barrier? F-35 jets or drones flying overhead?
Oh, well, they did better than break the sound barrier. You know, when I've experienced this breaking of the sound barrier with Israeli jets, usually I don't see them. This time they flew right over the stadium, so close to the spectators that we could see the details of the bottom of the fuselage. There were four fighter jets that came screaming over. They couldn't have been more than a couple hundred meters above the stadium. They weren't going in excess of the speed of sound. They were actually going relatively slowly. And this happened at the very moment, they timed it to perfection. This happened at the very moment when they brought the coffin of Hassan Nasrallah from out behind a curtain into the stadium. It was a very emotional moment for many of the people. Tens of thousands of people were literally crying at that moment. And as soon as they flew over, tears turned to rage and people began chanting death to Israel. Then they calmed down. The ceremony continued, they took the coffin. It wasn't just one coffin, by the way, because Israel, a month after they assassinated Nasrallah, they assassinated his presumed successor, Hashem Safieddine. So it was actually both of the coffins. They laid Hassan Nasrallah to rest last night, but today they were burying Hashem Safieddine. They took his coffin to the south of Lebanon, where he's from. So after the Israeli jets flew over, they took the coffin around the stadium. This was something they'd always planned to do so that people would have an opportunity to see and touch the coffins. And then came the speech from the current Secretary General, Naim Qassem, who spoke from a huge video screen from a remote location. Obviously, they determined it was too dangerous to have him appear in person. And while he was speaking, the four Israeli F-35s did another very low overflight, again, provoking, angry chants of defiance from the people in the crowd.
And they were F-35s.
Yes, it was clear. I mean, they were so close, you could clearly make out what they were. They were F-35s.
Now, this is, I find this astonishing. I mean, as much as I know about this, I find it astonishing that Israel is violates Lebanese airspace day and night all the time, and has been doing it for years. F-35s, F-16s, drones of various sorts. Some years ago, a couple of years ago, I spoke with a Lebanese sound artist and documentarist who had actually documented all of the overflights over the course of, I don't know, 5 or 10 years. And there were like thousands upon thousands of documented overflights up and down Lebanon, you know, between the Mediterranean and Syria, from Israel to the north of Lebanon and back down again, all the time, all the time. And so, you know, Lebanon, I presume, has no functioning air force, and Israel is in complete command of Lebanese airspace and can do this. I find this astonishing.
It was surreal, David. You know, it's like you're at the, you know, the Super Bowl or the Grey Cup, and, you know, you're at the Super Bowl and the U.S. Air Force sends 5 planes overhead. You know, they're part of the National Air Force where the Super Bowl is taking place. And imagine if it was Russian jets flying over the Super Bowl. I mean, the United States would go absolutely berserk. Right here, it's commonplace. And the weirdest part about this was the entire time we were in there, there was a Cessna, which I was told before the Israeli warplanes flew overhead, a Cessna was circling constantly for the entire time. You could see it. And it was from the quote-unquote Lebanese Air Force. The thing basically got out of the way so that these Israeli F-35s could do their, you know, little act of terrorism, you know, in twice during the course of the ceremony with absolutely no resistance. And all around the stadium, of course, on the ground, there were Lebanese forces everywhere, you know, carrying automatic weapons and, you know, some armored personnel carriers. So the military was present, but utterly powerless to stop this. It was just unimaginable, the degree to which Israel is permitted to violate the sovereignty of Lebanon and neighboring states with total impunity.
And, you know, I was going to get to this later on, but we might as well get to it now, and then we can get back to Lebanon. But Netanyahu has just announced that moving forward, Syria, the new Syrian government, and HTS, I think those are the three letters, I mean that faction, and the new Lebanese, the new Syrian armed forces will not be allowed. Israel will not allow them to have any presence south of Damascus. And Israel is demanding that all of southern Syria be demilitarized and that no Syrian armed forces will be allowed to be present in any of the, I think, 3 or 4 provinces south of Damascus. And Israel has the audacity to say that, but it has the complete freedom and complete liberty to actually enforce that, and the international community allows it to do it. It's a complete violation of the sovereignty of the Syrian Republic. But Israel is completely free to violate the sovereignty of Lebanese airspace, Syria. It can do what it wants.
Yeah, and this is...
And yet Iran is the supremely malign, aggressive force across the Middle East and Southwest Asia. It is Iran that poses the supreme threat, not simply to regional security, but to the security of the entire planet, and not Israel.
Mm-hmm. And remember, you know, Israel has illegally annexed the Syrian Golan Heights and attacked Syria with complete impunity hundreds of times while it was committing genocide in Gaza. There were no attacks from the Syrian army on, not even on the occupied Golan Heights, David. They didn't even attack. There were attacks coming from Lebanon on the occupied Golan Heights, but there were no attacks, none that I am aware of, even claimed by Israel with or without evidence, from Syrian territory on the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. And yet they're acting as if there is a threat in Syria to Israel. There's no evidence whatsoever that the either the predecessor government of Assad or the current regime poses any kind of a significant military threat to Israel. None. And yet they're claiming, you know, they're taking it upon themselves to declare a buffer zone on Syrian territory. Astonishing.
Who was Hassan Nasrallah, for those who don't know? And what was his significance for Lebanese people? And not simply for Hezbollah, but for the broader Lebanese society and community.
He was born in 1960 to a working class family in Beirut. He studied for a significant amount of time as a young man in Iran. Religious studies. He studied Shia Muslim theocracy, I'll put it that way. He was a respected religious intellectual, returned to Lebanon, became active in the resistance at the time when he became involved with Hezbollah, which is whose military wing is known as the Islamic Resistance in Lebanon. Israel was occupying the country and had been occupying it for a number of years. In 1992, during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, Israel assassinated the second secretary general of Hezbollah, whose name is Abbas al-Musawi. They fired a Hellfire missile from an Apache helicopter into a vehicle in which al-Musawi was with his wife and their little boy. They were all instantly killed. And at that point, Nasrallah, who was 32 years old at the time, became the third secretary general of Hezbollah. And he remained there for 33 years. And when you consider the frequency and adroitness with which Israel assassinates the leaders of resistance groups, that in and of itself is a remarkable achievement, that he remained in that position for 33 years. In 2000, under his command, Hezbollah and other resistance groups, but overwhelmingly it was Hezbollah, the Islamic Resistance, drove Israel from Lebanon. Then in 2006, there was a 4 to 5 week war in the south of the country. At that point in time, Hezbollah sent, the Islamic Resistance sent commandos into Israel to kidnap some soldiers for the purpose of using them to trade for Lebanese citizens, some of whom were military, some of whom were civilian, who were in Israeli dungeons. So that provoked a brutal war. But Israel, the soldiers were taken from the Israeli soldiers from northern occupied Palestine into a village called Ait Ashab, which is right on the Israeli border. I was there during the last year, and it was had suffered enormous damage. But they didn't even manage to take in 2006 Ait Ashab, this little village, which was quite a scandal. And at that time, the Israeli prime minister was Ehud Olmert. And I think that this contributed ultimately to his political demise. It was a very sort of embarrassing moment for the Israeli military. They were driven from the country again. And at that time, I think Nasrallah attained a certain level of preeminence in the Arab world, not just in Lebanon and not just in Shia circles, but amongst the broader Arab public. He was widely admired for leading the organization. At that point, he coined this phrase, this famous phrase, that Israel is weaker than a spider's web. Then came the Syrian war, and Nasrallah was confronted with a difficult choice. I don't think my own guess is that he did not want to intervene in that war. He made the decision ultimately at a point where Bashar al-Assad's regime was in serious trouble, that he would commit thousands of Hezbollah fighters to aid Bashar al-Assad. And I think the reason that he made that decision, frankly, remember Assad, amongst other things, was a secularist, whereas Hezbollah, the Party of God, is a Shia Muslim political and military movement. So it wasn't obvious that, Hezbollah would commit its forces to defend the regime of Assad. But it was critically important to Hezbollah that they maintain a land bridge to Iran, because Iran was supplying them with missiles, without which it would be very difficult for them to defend their territory from Israeli attacks. So I think that was the calculus. Hezbollah fought ferociously in that war, and I think made a very significant contribution to defeating the rebels, most of whom were jihadis who were funded and armed by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United States, Turkey, and Israel. And so that left, a significant stain on his legacy. There were people within the Arab world who were upset, and understandably so, that he committed significant resources to defend the regime of Bashar al-Assad. But I think it was very much an existential question for Hezbollah. And then came, this war. It began with, Hezbollah maintained, and Nasrallah was adamant, that he did not know about the October 7th attacks. And I think that independent experts widely accept that he did not know. But as soon as it happened, he anticipated, as many of us did, that there would be a ferocious response. And so he committed to launch limited attacks upon Israeli military forces within, I think originally it was like a 12-kilometer band of the border. And the purpose, as he explained, was to draw resources from the Israeli military away from Gaza and the West Bank to the north. And the Israeli forces were, in fact, obliged to do that. But then things started to escalate very considerably. Israel was taking a beating. The settlers who lived in the northern colonies were very upset with the Netanyahu government because they felt that they were not being defended. I think it was in excess of 100,000, maybe hundreds of thousands of people had to be evacuated from dozens of Israeli towns and villages in the north. And as their anger accumulated and they increasingly accused Netanyahu's regime of abandoning them, the Israeli government predictably resorted to the most brutal of methods to crush Hezbollah. And part of that was an assassination. And they assassinated Nasrallah finally after 33 years as Secretary General on September 27th of last year. I went to the site of the assassination. It's stunning the lengths that they went to, David, to kill him. They actually used dozens of 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs in a densely populated residential area of Beirut. They didn't take down just one set of buildings. They took down multiple sets of buildings because they weren't quite sure where he was. Somehow they had information that he was in an underground facility under some of those buildings. And so to ensure that they didn't miss him, they took out all of the buildings where he thought he might be situated. And so they killed quite a few people on that day. As I mentioned, a month later, after they killed him, they assassinated, in a similar but not quite as destructive airstrike, Hashem Safieddine, and that led to the decision to put Nassim Kaim in power.
Dimitri Lascaris is a lawyer, human rights activist, and journalist based in Montreal and Kalamata, Greece. Watch our complete conversation and link to Dimitri's media platform, Reason to Resist, at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. Now. Thank you.
You're listening.